Hi everybody, thanks for coming to the Wesson Library. My name is Bridget, I'm a library associate here. We are welcoming Stephen Hansen. He's the author of History of DuPont Circle, Center of My Society in the Capitol. I'll leave it to Stephen, and thank you for coming.
Good evening everyone, thank you for coming. So I guess you know who I am at this point. This is my second book. The first one I wrote was a history of Kalorama Triangle in Washington, which a lot of you know is just north of DuPont Circle. It's not a great seller. To me it was very interesting history, but I think to your average reader, there's not enough to really capture you as much as there was or is with the history of DuPont Circle. And originally I was very reluctant to write this book. Some of my colleagues said, well, you wrote a history of Kalorama Triangle, why don't you write one of DuPont Circle? And, you know, Kalorama Triangle has, you know, 3,000 people and a limit, kind of a narrow history, though very interesting, but DuPont Circle is large and very rich. But at the same time, I write a monthly column for the In-Towner newspaper, and I had been writing about, the history of the Treasury Building and, you know, Sutter's Tavern and things like that, but every time I wrote something about DuPont Circle, I got a lot of positive feedback. People just seemed to love it. And then I got, by training and profession, I'm actually an architectural historian, but I thought, well, you know, what's really interesting is the social history of a neighborhood, I think, social and economic history. But still, I didn't want to try to put it together in a book. And then I started thinking about it, such a rich history, but if you selected certain people and events over a long period of time, you could actually tell one story of DuPont Circle. And of course, there are hundreds and hundreds of stories that could be told. So my book is just one path through a very wide history. When I signed the contract with a publisher, the page limit was 160 pages. I was up to 300 in 2 months. And the editor said, well, you know, we won't publish that. So just give us what you've got and we'll cut out what we need to get it down to the page limit. Well, they took about 75% of the book. So that was very exciting. And the rest of it's still on my floor and it's about this tall in notes and photographs and everything. But just to start, overview. A lot of you probably know that DuPont Circle was home to Representative James Blaine. His house still stands at 2000 Massachusetts Avenue. Theodore Roosevelt, who actually lived in DuPont Circle twice before he was president. William Howard Taft lived right on DuPont Circle, number 5. And then Cissy Patterson, whose house you see here on the cover, which recently sold for, was it 20 million, 22 million? Which is unfortunately they're going to tear the 1930s annex off the back, and they're going to build a glass block, and that's going to be micro apartments. So these will be like 400 square feet apartments with shared kitchens and things like that. But also, a lot of people don't know that DuPont Circle was also home to people like Julia Grant, who was Ulysses S. Grant's widow, and also her extended family. Also Alexander Graham Bell and his father-in-law Graham Greene Hubbard. And there was a whole Hubbard Bell clan, which was just south of DuPont Circle down Massachusetts Avenue. Also George Hearst, who is the father of William Randolph Hearst. And George Hearst came to Washington to fill a vacant Senate seat and then stayed on. So the neighborhood is a cast of hundreds. So as I said in the book, I tried to select those which would actually give you hopefully a good sense of the general history. The book is titled Center of High Society in the Capitol. So what I'd like to do is give you a quick introduction to high society in Washington, which started in the early 1800s. And it centered right, this is a modern painting actually of Lafayette Square. It's on display at the White House Historical Society. So there were basically, in the early 1800s, two types of high society members. And those were members of the residential society and also official society. Now, the residential folks had moved to Washington in the early presidential administrations, Madison, late Adams. And they were Democrats from mostly Virginia. They were landed plantation owners with lots of slaves. And they kept their plantations, but they also built homes around Lafayette Square. And examples of those folks are Stephen Decatur, General Benjamin Ogle Taylor, and Dolly Madison. Now, the Taylor House and the Madison House still stand on the east side of Lafayette Square. Official society consisted of political people who were either elected officials or presidential appointees. And that was quite stratified. And your level within official society really depended on how much time you spent in Washington over the year. So if you're a cabinet member, you're here a good chunk of the year. The people who are here, probably here the most at the time, were Supreme Court members. And they were at the top of the social pecking order. And it worked its way down to senators. And then the lowest of lows were representatives. And they were here for such a short period of time. And they were incredibly busy living in boarding houses. So they really weren't part of the social scene. And this is basically how Washington was the first 50 years of its history until the Civil War came. And with the Civil War, the Democrats basically lost. And the city was suddenly flooded with Republicans. The people who stayed really had lost their financial backing. Their plantations were destroyed and just weren't economically viable. So they stayed, but they had to go underground socially. And they were hiding out from the new Republicans who were coming in. And they gained the nickname cave dwellers because they basically went underground. They never came out socially unless, you know, a daughter or a granddaughter needed a debutante coming out cotillion. And they only socialized with each other. And they maintained a tradition of having very intimate sit-down dinners and high tea. So this is a map of the DuPont Circle area about 1860-1861. And you can see there's not really a lot going on in the DuPont Circle neighborhood. Now, the cave dwellers are down here on the floor. This is Lafayette Square. And here's Connecticut Avenue and what would eventually become from a field, DuPont Circle. There are a couple interesting things in the first half of the 1800s, which I like to talk about. One is Holmes Burial Ground, or the Western Burial Ground. It was one of two public cemeteries in Washington. The other one at the time, or still is, was Congressional Cemetery. And Holmes Burial Ground was at the top of 19th, and here's Florida Avenue. It wasn't very big. It was just this, not even a full city block. And a lot of notable people were buried there. William O'Neill, who also had built his summer home here, just north of DuPont Circle. William O'Neill was the proprietor of Franklin House down on I Street, where a lot of the representatives stayed and they boarded when they came to Washington to serve their terms. He had a very prominent, famous, notorious daughter, Peggy O'Neill Timberlake, who you might know brought down Jackson's administration, causing the kitchen cabinet scandal. She was quite a character, and I get into her quite a bit in the book. Back to Holmes Burial Ground, there's very notable people buried there. One of the first was James McGurk, who was the first man executed in Washington. In 1802, he came home very drunk one night, beat his wife silly. She gave birth to stillborn twins, and she died a couple days later. Really, the courts and the judges didn't know what to do because this was the first time that they were facing an execution. And Jefferson got involved, and it was suddenly discovered that our judicial system had a big hole in it, that no one had the authority to sign the writ of execution. So Jefferson spent months writing letters trying to figure out who could sign it. So he ultimately did. One of the things that happened was the night after McGurk was buried, family members of a young woman who was buried in the plot next to him got very upset that their child was buried next to this murder. So they snuck into the cemetery the next night and they dug McGurk up and they put him, they relocated him just north of Florida Avenue. Well, McGurk was Irish and there was a big kind of clan at the time. So McGurk's friends found out about this. So the next night they went, found where the body was buried, dug it up, and put it back where it was supposed to be in the cemetery. The next night, the family members came, they dug up McGurk one more time, and they buried him out about here in the marshes of Slash Run, expecting that he would never be found again. Well, about 30 years later, somebody was excavating to build the basement for their new house, and they came across human remains, and some of McGurk's old friends said, yeah, that's where we put him. Also buried in Holmes Cemetery was James Hoban, the architect of the White House, and Lewis Payne, who was one of the Lincoln conspirators. He was also buried there. The cemetery lasted until the 1870s, where it was, you can guess, it became quite full. It had over 7,000 official burials, and if you can imagine in a spot this small, people were burying family members 2 and 3 deep. And another problem was, when Boundary Street, what was then Boundary Street, which is now Florida Avenue, was leveled, because it used to be up quite high, they exposed the side of the cemetery, leaving 7 and 8 feet above street level. Well, you can imagine things were falling out onto the street, hitting carriages. Also in the 1870s, there started to be families in the area and small children who were playing in the cemetery, and people would look out their windows and become quite upset seeing young boys having sword fights with human bones. Or at one point, the one boy was walking down the street with a skull on a stick with a lot of young kids parading behind him. So the cemetery finally got closed down and most of the bodies were relocated to Georgetown, Oak Hill, and other places. What's there now? It's the Monroe apartment building. It's a Spanish colonial yellow stucco building right on Florida Avenue. So I always wonder if people hear things at night or see things. I mean, I'm always fascinated by ghost stories. Another notable feature of DuPont Circle before the Civil War, and actually as late as the 1870s, is Hopkins Brickyard. The Hopkins were two brothers from Georgetown who initially bought a little brick-making yard, and they just kept expanding because there was nothing to stop them. So they were spread over Massachusetts Avenue, north of DuPont Circle. They eventually bought Billy O'Neill's summer house, and that's where one of the brothers ended up living. It was so spread out that when they went to extend Massachusetts Avenue properly out to Florida Avenue, where it ended, they had to basically kick a lot of the kilns out of the way and clear those off. Also, Slash Run was a brook that ran down to the east of DuPont Circle. It started up around 17th Champlain Street, came down to about M Street, and then turned and ran into Rock Creek Park. Unfortunately, in the 1850s, John Little, who was a butcher who had a stand in Central Market, put his slaughterhouse right up at the top of the stream, and he was throwing offal and blood and everything into the stream, and it just rolled down through DuPont Circle area, and people said it smelled pretty bad. But strangely enough, right where the creek in Slash Run was, it formed a kind of a swampy pool, which strangely enough became a very popular swimming spot. So people were desperate to swim. So basically stayed this rural and out of the way until we got a new government, local government in 1871 with the Organic Act, which gave us a governor, presidentially appointed, Henry Cook. We got a legislative assembly, also presidentially appointed, House of Delegates, which was actually locally elected, and a Board of Public Works with five members on it. Now, Governor Cook was actually the head of the board, but one of the members was Alexander Baugh Shepherd, who took a very assertive role in the Board of Public Works to the point where Governor Cook just didn't even show up at meetings anymore. So it was basically Baugh Shepherd's scene. You might know he launched citywide improvements, very expensive, put the city into debt, and basically toppled the local government. It was so bad. But one of his big projects was paving streets and planting, plumbing, bringing water to houses, gas lights. And he had selectively picked areas of the city and certain streets for his improvements. And basically what he was doing was laying ground stone, macadamiaizing it was called. And in a couple rare places, they were also trying out asphalt. It was a relatively new concept for paving streets. Select streets, he decided would be poured concrete. But he didn't do anything about that until 1871. And all of a sudden, Connecticut Avenue, down from his house, which is on the corner of Connecticut and K Street, all the way to the edge of the city at Florida, ended up being basically an 8-lane poured concrete highway. People are like, what's going on here? Beautifully planted sidewalks, curbs, lighting. Like, really wasn't called for that. But at the same time, at the same time, a real estate syndicate had started in Washington buying up properties for investment and resale. And it was headed up by three silver kingpins from the West Coast, California and Nevada. One of them was Curtis Justice Hillier. The others were Representative William Stewart and Thomas Sutherland. And they had bought up all the lots around DuPont Circle all the way over to Logan Circle at the same time of Baugh Shepherd's improvements, though they claimed that they knew nothing about what Shepherd had been planning. So unfortunately, the bottom fell out of the silver market in the early 1870s because there was a big push to replace silver with gold as the monetary standard. So our silver miners, their fortunes were challenged, and they found themselves holding a lot of land. Well, the syndicate approached William Stewart and said, Bill, you've got to build a house up there in our investment, something big, and it'll make people want to move up there. So Stewart basically took the last of his money and he built the first mansion in DuPont Circle, which was one DuPont Circle, obviously. It was called at the time Stewart's Castle because of its size, but a lot of people started calling it Stewart's Folly because it was in the middle of nowhere, and I thought, oh, he was absolutely crazy. It's this one here. So he moved in, started entertaining on a grand scale, and people would actually make the trip up from Lafayette Square to attend dinner parties and balls. The next year, Curtis Hillier also decided to build his house. He built at 21st and Massachusetts Avenue. Hillier survived the financial crisis of the early 1870s because he had a very successful law practice on the West Coast. So he was able to keep generating income to support his life in Washington. There is. I'll jump to that right now, actually. Hillier lived in the house for about almost 30 years. He was increasingly going deaf, and he got to the point where he couldn't practice law anymore, and he decided the house was too much. So he moved up to 21st Street in the middle of his development that he had started in Hillier Place. His house there on 21st Street still stands. It's been, the Phillips collection has expanded back up north on 21st Street, and About 20 years ago, they kind of subsumed his house. So it's still there.
What year was that?
The Hilliard House? Yeah. This was about 1873 it started. So DuPont Circle was still not taking off socially, and people still weren't investing in lots there because there was a recession of 1873 caused by the silver issue. But in 1873, that same year, Sir Edward Norton, who was the head of the British legation in Washington, decided that he would also build in the DuPont Circle area. The British legation had been on H Street in the building right to the east of St. John's Church. It still stands. It looks kind of Victorianized now, but it's actually a very old building.
The Episcopalian Church, St. John's?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. So the building still stands. So when Sir Edward decided to build in Washington, it was the first foreign investment in the city. And he bought some land from the real estate syndicate at Connecticut and N Streets and constructed the British Legation building. Not only did it bring social life north to DuPont Circle, it also became the center of Washington social life. You weren't anybody in Washington society until you had been invited to the British Legation for an event. And what actually knocked you to the top of the social echelon is if British Legation staff and possibly even the ambassador himself went to your home for an event or attended your event. So this was a great illustration from Collier's in the 1870s showing a lawn party at the old British Legation house. 7 years later, see, not a lot's happening, in 1880, a representative from Maine, James Blaine, who possibly was very corrupt, I didn't want to pursue it, he had such names as Slippery Jim. For some reason, he was basically a professional politician, he was a representative from Maine. He was also served about four terms as Secretary of State and made two runs for president. In 1880, when Garfield was elected, he appointed Blaine Secretary of State, at which point Blaine thought that he was set and it was time to build his mansion. So he got the same architect, John Fraser, who designed the British Legation to build his house at 2000 Massachusetts Avenue, which is still standing there. But his career didn't go as he had planned. Garfield was assassinated a few months after Blaine had moved into the house. Blaine did not last very long in the next administration and had to resign. At this point, he couldn't afford to keep this house anymore. He had previously bought himself a house in Lafayette Square. He felt quite at home with the cave dwellers. So it's the Seward Mansion, which he bought and remodeled and moved back there. He didn't want to sell the house, so he rented it out. And he found a family, a little-known family from Chicago called the Leiters. And he rented the house to them in 1883. And as I'll get to in a few minutes, the Leiters actually changed the face of Washington society. So it's quite a pleasant surprise. Stuart had to go back to the West Coast. He was penniless. He made another fortune in mining, but when he left in 1886, he rented the house out to the Chinese legation in Washington. Now, the Chinese had been here for a while, kind of low cover, but when they moved in here, they became very high profile and quite an oddity and attraction. People used to parade up Connecticut Avenue on Sundays hoping to catch a sight of the Chinese staff somewhere around the house. Now the Chinese sort of attracted this attention themselves. They would do things like take their laundry and lay it out in DuPont Circle to dry, or they'd be running hide and seek around the trees and the plants in the circle. So they were quite interesting to the local folks. The ambassador did not entertain too much in the house. I think he had two large dinner parties. He wasn't too fond of guests, really. So when he wanted them to leave, he'd burn red peppers in the room. And the room would just fill with smoke, and people's eyes would start burning, and they would leave. when the Chinese finally moved out, they left the house quite a wreck. The red peppers left a mess, but also the staff were very fond of opium. So the whole house was just opium stained, the walls, the windows, the expensive silk upholstered European furniture was all burned and stained, and Stuart was not very happy about that. In the early 1880s, Washington saw another wave of immigration social sets, and that were military leaders who had followed the great Civil War generals to Washington, General Sheridan, Grant himself, and they were basically in two camps. One was high-ranking officers who were hoping to get jobs in the ever-expanding war or Navy departments or government military contracting. And the other set of military folks were just rich. And they moved to Washington seeking political power and influence with, you know, those who had got the jobs in the War Department or the president himself. They mixed pretty well with the cave dwellers and also very well with official society. The other wave of immigrants to Washington in the early 1880s were the nouveau riche, and they were folks who had made their fortunes during the Civil War, either during the Civil War or from the Civil War, and not always in the most ethical ways. Mark Twain couldn't stand these people, and he wrote a book in 1872 called The Gilded Age, and nicknamed them the parvenus, which is kind of from the French parvenir, to arrive. The parvenus thought that they had arrived in society with their money. Mark Twain kind of epitomized the parvenus in a character called Patrick O'Reilly. Patrick O'Reilly had made a fortune selling exorbitantly overpriced shingle nails to the government during the war. So with his fortune, he took his family to Europe with the intent to return speaking English with a foreign language. He also changed his name. He went from Patrick O'Reilly to Patrick, and what he thought was the French spelling of O'Reilly, which really came out Aurier, which is French for ear, and Twain never mentions if he actually knew what the French word meant. The cave dwellers were considered gauche, kind of crass. They were not accepted by the cave dwellers at all, and were actually not by official society or the military set. Let me shift podium here. So I mentioned the Leiters, who in the 1880s had rented James Blaine House on Massachusetts Avenue. Blaine rented them the house for $11,500 a year, which if you do the calculations now, you can just guess how much that was. Well, the Leiters loved telling everybody how much they were paying for rent, trying to impress some people that they were so rich that money was no object, but the locals are thinking they were just getting suckered by Blaine. So the joke started there. They actually became, you know, what I'm calling them the parvenus par excellence. They were very ostentatious, social climbers, and really had, I guess in the book I say, questionable sophistication. Now, it's interesting, when I submitted the manuscript of my book to the editor, he called me the next day and said, "I don't think you can say that about the Leiters." And I said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "Well, what if they're still around?" And I said, "Well, wait a minute, I'll call you back." And I went down the street, because Levi Leiter's great-great-grandson is my next-door neighbor. He looks just like this, too. And I said, "Colin, can I call your family parvenus and say they were ostentatious and heirs of pretension?" He said, "Absolutely." So I went back, called my editor, and I said, "It's okay with the Leiters." And he's like, "Okay." So the Leiters ended up building their own home at 1500 New Hampshire Avenue. At the time it was built, it was the largest private residence in Washington. Levi had to make an impression.
What was his profession?
Levi Leiter was one of the founders of what eventually became Marshall Fields. He went into the dry goods business with Potter and Marshall Field himself. And the Leiter sold out. He was the first. and they carried on and eventually became
until.
That's where this jacket came from. I'm pretty proud of that. I am very proud of this jacket. I hope it lasts forever. Yeah, okay. Mary was a school teacher initially when Levi married her. And she came to Washington and they were like bulls in a china shop socially. Mary was most well known for her malaprops. They attracted a lot of attention. Basically, they were hoping Mary would slip up and say something, and she did very often. At one point, they're returning from Europe, and the press ran up to Mary Leiter and said, "Mrs. Leiter, how does it feel to be back in the United States?" And she said she was very, very happy to have her feet back on terracotta. One of her favorite things to do was show guests one of her prized possessions that they had gotten in Europe, and that was a bust of her daughter's hand by Rodin. One night at a dinner party, Margaret Cassini, who was the French ambassador's daughter, was at the dinner party and was experiencing her first bowl of terrapin soup, which was the standard starter then. I mean, if you had any class in money, you served terrapin soup. Well, Marguerite took one sip and pushed it away. Now, this is a very large dining room, and she was on the far end as one of the new guests, and Mary Leiter was on the other end. And she stood up and she screamed, "You can't refuse my terrapin. It cost me $100. So Mary went head-to-head with the cave dwellers at one point. When it was time for her youngest daughter's Daisy's cotillion, her coming-out party, Mary scheduled it in April. And it happened to be the same night that the cave dwellers had planned they had an annual subscription ball raising money for charity. And anyone who was anybody was invited to and went to this charity event. So the cave dwellers were quite upset about this, and they just sent Mary a little note saying, "Would you consider moving the night of your daughter's cotillion because it's the same night as our dance?" Mary fired a note off immediately back saying, "No, move yours." Well, neither side decided to reschedule their events, and it became a big social standoff. I mean, the whole city was talking about this. And a lot of the younger people were quite concerned because they were invited to both events, and Mary just assumed that you would go to hers. And then Mary also made it very clear that if you did not attend her ball for her daughter, you would be stricken from her invitee list forever. So folks figured it out, it's like, well, if we go to the subscription ball first, we'll leave early enough that we can get over to the lighter so we can go to both. So everyone shows up to the subscription ball, but the cave dwellers had barricaded the doors once everyone got in, and no one could leave. And they're thinking, oh no. Well, Julia Grant's grandson, who was, his last name was Satoris, figured out if he bribed one of the wait staff, he'd let him out the kitchen door out the back. So he bribed his way out and went running across DuPont Circle, made it to the lighters. Well, everyone else figured this out too. So the one waiter who was manning the back door ended the evening with his pockets full of money. And most people made it over to Mary Leiter's that evening too. A couple didn't, and Sartoris describes them as sort of cowering inside the hall with the cave dwellers thrown against the doors, keeping them from leaving. But in the end, Mary Leiter became very popular, and even though people liked to laugh at her and talk about her, the city became very fond of her. And under her leadership, what was once those who were once parvenus became members of a new accepted social set, and that was called the smart set. And Mary Leiter became the queen of the smart set until she died, and she passed the crown on to Mary Townsend, who bought Curtis Hillier's house. I'll get to that in a second. The Leiters had four children. The three daughters were basically pages out of Edith Wharton's The Buccaneers. Mary had decided that she had gone as far as she could in Washington society. So she realized if she could marry her daughters off to titled Europeans without money, that would elevate her social status. And she was right. Her eldest daughter, Mary Victoria, ended up marrying Lord George Curzon in 1895. He became the Viceroy of India, and Mary Victoria became the Vicereine. And when she died, unfortunately she died at a young age, 1903, at her death she was the highest ranking American in British society. Nancy, the middle daughter here, you can see she got all the looks. She got her father's looks. She was visiting her sister Mary in India and met a General Colin Clark. They fell in love and got married. And then Daisy the youngest, whose cotillion caused such a scandal, married the Earl of Suffolk. Joseph, the only son, was quite a robber baron, in my opinion. When he graduated from Harvard, his father, Levi, gave him $1 million just to see how he would handle it. Well, Joseph decided he would try to corner the wheat market in Chicago. Well, didn't work out. The bottom fell out of the wheat market, and Joseph lost $1 million plus some. So Levi had to bail him out. He did make his fortune back many times over. Problem was, he was known as being quite an extravagant spender. He would buy 1,000 pairs of silk socks in a single go. And this went on and on, grand entertaining in the Leiter mansion. But finally, when he tried to buy the Great Wall of China, his sister Daisy decided he had gone too far, and she sued him for mismanagement of the family estate and the fortune. The battle went on in court for years, and Joseph finally prevailed. Now, Mary Townsend, in my mind, is a very interesting character. She made the transition from cave dweller to the smart set. Most members of the smart set would, die and be a cave dweller. But Mary went the other way. She spent her early years on Lafayette Square. Her father was a congressman from Pennsylvania. So she grew up in Jackson Place, nice, good-sized house. She married the president of the Pennsylvania Railroad. So all of a sudden, she's got more money than she knows what to do with. So she decides to move back to Washington to take advantage of social life in Washington. She moved back into her father's house. It wasn't big enough, because at this point in time, the small intimate dinners and teas that the cave dwellers were having were passé. What people were doing was having very large dinner parties, sit down for 50 or 60. So Mary added on to the house on Lafayette Square, basically a separate dining room, which ended up not being large enough for what she wanted to do. So she decided to look for another house, and at this point in time, everyone is moving to DuPont Circle. There's a lot of open land, so people, the filthy rich, could build their huge Beaux-Arts mansions and take up several house lots. But Mary had this fear or phobia that if she ever moved into a new house, she would die. So she found out that Curtis Hillier was selling his house at 21st and Massachusetts Avenue. So she thought, this is perfect. It's an old house. I'll move in. Well, it wasn't big enough. Here's the original house. It wasn't big enough. So Mary added on to it. She added a huge ballroom and a huge library. But she wasn't happy with the style. So she encased the whole original house in the new in vogue Beaux-Arts architectural style. So you can sort of see here is the original Hillier house. And if you look around the back and if you get inside and open certain closet doors, you can actually see part of the original Hillier house.
Is that the Cosmos?
Ding, yeah.
Cosmos?
Yeah, it stayed in the family until 1950. Sumner Wells' son actually ended up in the house, at which point the Wells estate sold it to the Cosmos Club in 1950. So yes, you know it as the Cosmos Club now. So Mary thinks she's all set in the house, but unfortunately, just as they moved in, her husband Richard was horseback riding in Rock Creek Park, was thrown, and his neck was broken, so he died. So I'm not quite sure if Mary's phobia was ultimately cured. Now, the smart set became parents. The lighter's children weren't, they're a little bit cut above the general smart set because of their wealth. When Levi died, I think he was worth $1.3 billion in today's money. Yeah, in today's money. So their children are a little bit older. But the children of the smart set in DuPont Circle, I've kind of nicknamed DuPont Circle's Brat Pack. And it was led by three very strong personalities. One was Alice Roosevelt, who was Teddy Roosevelt's eldest daughter. She didn't live in DuPont Circle until years later. I'll talk to her about that in a bit. Another was Cissy Patterson, who initially came to Washington to visit her mother, Eleanor, who was originally Eleanor Metal from the Chicago publishing fortune, who built her house at 15 DuPont Circle, which is still there, which has just been sold and is going to be turned into micro apartments. But fortunately, the plan is to keep the large staterooms in the original house as they are, so we can still go in on the pretenses of going in to visit somebody and seeing those rooms.
Wait, is that the Democratic
Women's Party? It was. And the third member of the trio was Margaret Cassini, who was, she came with the Russian ambassador in the 1890s, ostensibly as his niece and ward. Well, she wasn't his niece. She was actually his daughter. But the ambassador's wife was an actress and musician and dancer. And she wasn't accepted by the Russian court, but he married her anyway, and they had this daughter. So when he came, he brought Marguerite as his niece, and his wife and her mother came ostensibly as the nanny. And that's how she remained in Washington. No one ever knew that she was the ambassador's wife, except the czar figured it out. So the first summer after they were in Washington, they were back in St. Petersburg, and the czar pulled the ambassador aside and said, "What's going on here?" So the ambassador confessed, and the czar said, "Well, I will recognize Marguerite as your daughter and give her a title." So all of a sudden, Marguerite Cassini returns to Washington after a summer, and she is now the Princess Cassini. And she actually ran the social life and events at the embassy. Alice and Cissy became fast friends initially, but things fell apart after a while, and they both ended up living on DuPont Circle, but they weren't friends. They had an on and off again feud for years. I mean, Cissy, who was running the what was she with papers at the time? The Washington Herald was lambasting Alice, and Alice was making terrible comments about Cissy. But at the same time, Alice would invite Cissy to dinner parties at her house. They had a history of competing for the same man. Cissy was after Alice's fiance and then later husband. And then Alice was trying to seduce Cissy's beaus at the same time. At one of her dinner parties, Alice went upstairs and found Cissy on the bathroom floor with the lights out with her husband. So Alice just quietly walked back downstairs. So Alice married Representative Nicholas Longworth, who ended up being long-term Speaker of the House. He was from Ohio. And in 1925, they bought the house at 2009 Massachusetts Avenue. Alice wasn't the first Roosevelt to live in this house. A cousin of hers, Robert Roosevelt, had bought it years before. And when he bought it, it was a red brick Victorian house. Looked just like the one next door to it. So the big architectural trend was Beaux-Arts style. So he expanded the house into the vacant lot next door and then refaced it with yellow limestone. And he excavated the front yard. There used to be a berm, and this used to be the front door. And these were the dormers of the house, which you can still see there, and if you go around the back. So Alice and Nicholas moved in 1925. They moved in with their one-year-old daughter, Paulina. Now, by Alice's own admission, Paulina was not Nicholas's daughter. Alice had an ongoing affair with William Borah, Representative William Borah, and this was his child. Everybody knew it too. So when Alice was expecting Paulina, she was considering naming her Deborah, which was a play on Deborah and Borah, Deborah. But everyone started saying they would just call the child Aurora Borealis. So the name quickly changed to Paulina. Nicholas died in 1931. And Alice stayed in the house. Okay. It's not mandatory, but restart now, postpone. All right, it's not that important. It's just the last slide. Anyway, Alice stayed in the house, and she became quite a power broker in her own right. She would hold big dinner parties and teas. And if you wanted to start a political career, you would try to get on Alice's good side. Not easy to do. If you wanted to keep your career, you tried to stay not on her nasty side. She could make or break someone's career. People claimed that Dewey lost his presidential bid because Alex publicly said he looked like the little man on the wedding cake with the penciled mustache. Alice is quite well known for her quips. At one point, Senator McCarthy came at her and said, "I think I'm going to call you Alice." And she said, "The policemen and the trash men on my block call me Alice. You may not." She always claimed that she always wore big brim hats. And in the 60s, she claimed she wore them so Lyndon Johnson wouldn't try to kiss her. At one point, Lyndon Johnson adored her. At one point, he insisted on showing her his appendix scar. And she turned around and she said, "Thank God it wasn't his prostate." She's probably best known for her quip, which made it onto a needlepoint pillow, which she used to show guests. And it said something like, "If you don't have anything nice to say about somebody, come sit right here next to me." Alice stayed in this house until she died at the age of 96 in 1980. She declined, the house declined. When she died, or in the 70s, the house was overgrown, the yard was bushes. There was poison ivy, and I like to think that Alice wanted the poison ivy there to scare people off. And she didn't want people to come just to see the house. At one point during the anti-war protests in DuPont Circle, Alice opened her bedroom window in the front of the house and got a big whiff of tear gas. And someone said, Mrs. Longworth, I mean, what about that tear gas?" And she said, "Oh, it just cleared my sinuses." Anyway, so when Alice died in 1980, I think the last scion of DuPont Circle's gilded or golden age ended. Alice was the first of Teddy Roosevelt's daughter's children to be born and the last to die. And I think her life sort of reflects the history of DuPont Circle down to its, I don't want to say decline, I'd say until its last change process. So with that, I'll stop and see if you have any questions or comments.